Hi, I'm Matt Richter, and this is another edition of Leadership Lessons from U.S. Presidents. Today, we'll focus on a 200-plus-year problem we've had in selecting the theoretically second most powerful position in the country, the vice presidency. After nearly two centuries of catastrophes like Andrew Johnson and a few got-lucky moments like Harry Truman, presidential candidates and their handlers have been dangerously careless and casual about the second-in-command selection. Not only has the serious selection of the VP been, well, neglected, once in the role, VPs have been ignored and relegated to ceremonial figureheads, rarely taking part in any substantive way in their president's administration. Two exceptions we'll briefly discuss are Andrew Jackson and his second VP, Martin Van Buren, and William McKinley and his first VP, Garrett Hobart. I believe those two examples, they're flukes, and they deviate from the norm. That is until the 39th president, Jimmy Carter. Carter, from the perch of historical perspective, saw the insanity and the irresponsible way VPs were both selected and then treated once in office. Carter teaches us about leadership, responsibility, and the risks associated with failing not to be responsible. Carter is more traditionally known for negotiating peace between Israel and Egypt. His Malaz speech, in which the word Malaz was never actually used, the Iranian hostage crisis, obscene oil prices, and battling Ted Kennedy for the nomination, and then getting shellacked by Ronald Reagan in 1980. These are the major touchstones in the Carter administration, but there is a little discussed leadership decision he made that had a tremendous impact on the executive branch in the United States. His selection of Walter Mondale was utterly unique and demonstrated how it should be done for future candidates, most of whom learned the lesson. He also changed the way the VP was integrated into the administration, making the argument that the number two guy actually added some value when it came to leading the country. Some of the key lessons we should take from this story are, number one, to pay attention to history. What occurred in the past is a great canvas filled with both positive and negative lessons leaders can use to make their own current decisions. Number two, conduct a risk assessment as to whether the negative events in the past are likely to hurt you. If so, mitigate them. Number three, just because something has always been done doesn't mean it should have been done or it should continue to be done. Okay, let's step back and look at a little of the history that led up to Carter transforming the VP selection and the role in the executive branch. As we mentioned in our previous podcast about John Tyler, leadership lessons are not exclusively associated with the greatest of presidents. Every president has provided some insight we can glob onto and use, illuminating the path forward as we ourselves take responsibility for guiding others towards some common objective. We saw how, with John Tyler, the role was diminished and relegated to the back burner. In fact, prior to Andrew Jackson, no president had seen any value in the VP, other than as a second stringer, a reservist waiting for calamity. Jackson was the first president to view the role differently from his predecessors and his successors. That is until our second exception, William McKinley. Jackson's first vice president was the legendary and perhaps infamous John Calhoun. Calhoun had been the VP under John Quincy Adams. Adams, of course, was Jackson's bitter rival, and Jackson and his followers believed Adams had stolen the 1828 election from them. That's a story for another time, however. Calhoun, rendered impotent in an Adams administration and constantly in conflict with the president, fell in with Jackson, unbelievably, agreeing to run as his VP in order to end the Adams era. But maybe the problem was actually Calhoun, because shortly into the Jackson first term, Calhoun was at it again, fighting with Jackson this time over his status in the administration. He quarreled particularly hard with Secretary of State Martin Van Buren. Van Buren, the little magician, was an amazing back office politician. He was also Jackson's right-hand man. Van Buren completely marginalized Calhoun politically, and Calhoun kept getting embroiled in personal squabbles and embarrassing situations with Jackson. As his main political advisor, confidant, and friend, Jackson saw fit to replace Calhoun with Van Buren for the 1832 re-election campaign. And given their relationship, Van Buren was fully integrated into the administration, a complete assistant president. He was viewed by Jackson as the successor, the one who would continue on the Jacksonian era. This was in of itself unprecedented, and it was unseen again, except for a brief respite in 1896, until Carter partnered with Mondale. If you think about it, no VP was ever utilized in other than ceremonial ways, as I said, and as the Senate president until the modern era. VPs were considered for Electoral College reasons. We need Southern representation. We need someone from New York to balance a ticket. Think about it. Teddy Roosevelt, relegated to ticker tape cuttings. Calvin Coolidge, utterly qualified, had no role in the Harding administration until Harding dropped dead. None of FDR's veeps even knew what was going on in the administration, including Truman, for weeks after he was elevated to the presidency, with regard to the bomb. I told you we'd get to the exception that proves the historical rule. So a guy named Garrett Hobart. Mr. Hobart was William McKinley's VP during the first term. They were extremely close friends. Hobart was a wealthy businessman who McKinley relied on extensively for advice and guidance. Hobart's wife acted as hostess for the White House when Mrs. McKinley was ill. Hobart died in 1899, leading McKinley to ultimately pick Teddy Roosevelt. McKinley did not pick Roosevelt because of his qualifications, though. He picked him because the New York political machines wanted to get Roosevelt out of New York, and the best possible way to get someone out of your state was to elevate him into the vice presidency, as long as the POTUS didn't, you know, get shot and killed, as was McKinley's case. The point is, McKinley utilized Hobart not because he was looking for a qualified VP. He utilized them because he wanted his best friend, his best advisor, near him. He didn't use the same criteria when forced to choose a new VP. He used political expediency as the driving decision metric. He was not motivated by qualification to run the country, and that's true for Jackson as well. Their motives were personal at best and selfish at worst. And that's what separates Jackson and McKinley from Jimmy Carter. Now, it would be naive to claim Carter acted from the purest of motives. But as we'll see, his rubric at least incorporated a very large component around competency. But we're still not yet at Carter. When looking at historical events, we have to look at context. Without Nixon, for example, and without Watergate, we don't get Jimmy Carter choosing Walter Mondale, at least for Carter's stated reasons. So let's fast forward to 1968. Richard Nixon, a man who should have known better, was the first vice president elected president who had not stepped into the role due to death. Having sat for 8 years as Eisenhower's second, you would have thought he might want a strong vice president he could groom given his own frustrations in the role. Other than stepping in when Ike was ill, which happened a few times, Nixon was rarely a thought in Ike's mind. Famously, when asked what contributions Nixon had made during his 8 years as VP, Ike said, "If you give me a few weeks, I might be able to come up with something." This question was asked during the tight Nixon-Kennedy race in 1960. Some support, huh? Nixon, however, relied on a poll that said when paired with any of the legitimate VP possibilities, Rockefeller, Agnew, Romney, Reagan, etc., he ran best if he ran alone. The least harmful, most potentially useful option was the governor of Maryland, Spiro Agnew. Agnew was known as tough on crime, a top-tier issue in 1968. He was also known for connecting with blue-collar white voters. Read that as racist. Agnew was the choice. He was an excellent hatchet man and was able to say extraordinarily inappropriate things that benefited Nixon without getting him dirty. Agnew's ability to raise money for Republicans and campaign in 1970 was also his largest responsibility as VP. Nixon clearly recognized Agnew's limitations and intentionally marginalized him, except to go out and make political speeches. there was quite a bit of talk about replacing Agnew on the ticket, but for a myriad of political reasons, Nixon and his team kept him. Then, Agnew was forced to resign when faced with charges of extortion, tax fraud, bribery, and conspiracy while acting as county executive of Maryland, governor of Maryland, and vice president. He took a plea deal, and with the agreement, he also agreed to resign the vice presidency. Nixon may have thought that the Agnew scandal might take the pressure away from the steamrolling Watergate, but it didn't. Nixon may or may not have seen the writing on the wall, but he knew he needed to replace Agnew with the 25th Amendment for the first time. He needed to replace Agnew with someone who very well might become president in a few short months. For Nixon, that meant his good friend, former Democratic Texan and new Republican John Connally. Connally had just switched parties in 1973. But there was no way he could convince the Republicans in Congress to support a former Democrat. Politically, Nixon needed to have someone disassociated with his administration so he could get that person through the confirmation process pretty easily. Ultimately, it was between George H.W. Bush and Gerald Ford. As the popular House minority leader, Ford was definitely the easier confirmation and therefore a no-brainer for Nixon. However, there is some evidence that Nixon didn't think very highly of Ford. John Ehrlichman, Nixon's White House counsel and top confidant, said after meeting Ford for the first time in 1969, "I came away from his office with the impression that Jerry Ford might have become a very good Grand Rapids insurance agent. He played a good game of golf, but he wasn't excessively bright." We can assume Nixon probably had similar sentiments. Okay, so why is all this backstory important before we even get to Jimmy Carter? Remember, prior to Nixon, presidents were very clearly willing to ignore their VPs. Prior to Nixon, no vice president was ever elected president in his own right after Van Buren. Hubert Humphrey, LBJ's VP, was the only VP other than Nixon to be nominated by a major party since Van Buren. Most VPs were held in so little regard, they weren't even considered by their parties as legitimate candidates. So with Nixon and Humphrey, the seeds of change were already brewing. The VP role was starting to be seen as a potential stepping stone into the presidency. But we weren't there yet. We needed someone to lead us over the threshold. Given the context of Watergate, given the context of Agnew, given the context of LBJ and Kennedy, given the context of George McGovern and his disastrous choice of Thomas Eagleton, truly a fun story for another time, Jimmy Carter was the first presidential candidate who actively searched for a true partner, a true assistant president. Even before he wrapped up the Democratic nomination, Carter worked on a selection plan to pick a running mate. This in of itself was a bit unique. Carter looked at over 400 Democrats. Prior to interviewing anyone, his aide, Hamilton Jordan, reminded him of his desire to structure the interview in such a way that really ascertained a candidate's capability to serve an important role on the team, as well as step into the president's shoes if needed. Even before he selected anyone, Carter planned to move the VP's office into the White House, something that had never been done. Think about it. The theoretically second most powerful person in the United States didn't even have an office in the executive house. All VPs since Carter have, though. Carter met with Walter Mondale. 2 years earlier, as the 1976 campaign was in its infancy, Mondale had said very clearly that he felt the person running for president should really want the job. He should want it so much as to be willing to suffer the discomfort of campaigning. Specifically, he had quipped that he didn't want to spend all of his time in Holiday Inns. Hamilton Jordan had developed an extremely complex rating system based on ability, integrity, and acceptance by the party to evaluate potential candidates. Mondale, along with four other senators, a few governors, and members of Congress, made the first cut. Carter decided he wanted to go with a senator, which would counter the knock on Carter being an outsider. Carter interviewed the final selections. He brought Mondale to his home. Mondale, for his part, came prepared. His mindset about campaigning having changed. His chief of staff prepared a paper on how Mondale could best fit into a Carter administration. Mondale had a position on every single issue the Carter folks asked. Mondale's level of preparation, along with his experiences in Washington, and the level of personal comfort the two men shared with each other, led Carter to pick him. But first, Mondale had to get around his firm stance about not wanting to go through a campaign. When asked, he said, "What I said at the time was that I did not want to spend most of my life in Holiday Inns. But I've checked, and I found that they've all been redecorated. They're marvelous places to stay, and I've thought it over, and that's where I'd like to be." Well, Carter and Mondale won, obviously, or they wouldn't be a part of this story. They beat Gerald Ford, trying to get elected in his own right, and his running mate Bob Dole. Mondale was the first truly activist vice president. He and Jimmy Carter established a weekly lunch just between the two of them, and this tradition has remained among presidents and vice presidents ever since. I mentioned the office, but Mondale was also a key figure in cabinet meetings, negotiations on the Hill, foreign affairs, etc. Mondale always supported Carter, and when the two did disagree, Mondale will express his concerns and make his case without retribution. He was the first vice president who had this role and position because the president believed the role should be structured this way. Mondale did not have power because of his previous relationship with the president. There wasn't one. And that, again, is the key difference. That is the fundamental takeaway. Jimmy Carter saw a massive hole in the way the executive branch was structured. There was no way to change the constitutional definition of the vice president. But through his own prescience and insight on the issue, Carter set a precedent for the role of VP that radically affected the position in general for the better. With the exception of Dan Quayle, all subsequent VPs were selected on some variation of Carter's rubric, ability, integrity, and acceptance by the party. So, what can we learn from Jimmy Carter's vice presidential selection process? Well, number one, see the gap. Let recent experiences, recent events, open your eyes to system breakdowns. Our failure to consider the VP properly led to some bad situations. John Tyler, Andrew Johnson, Dan Quayle, to name a few. Others were lucky outcomes, but they weren't intentionally chosen for their skills. For example, Teddy Roosevelt, Coolidge, Truman. Number two, close that gap. So you see it, now you close it. Evaluate the risk of not doing something and fix it. Carter had plenty of data points indicating change was in order. His changes are still with us today. Why is this example of great leadership? 37, remember Cleveland came to the plate twice, 37 men had been president before him. Even the greats like FDR and Lincoln had failed to see the possibilities of what a poor VP choice might lead to if they died. FDR had plenty of examples prior to 1932. He went through two VPs himself before settling on Truman for his fourth term. He completely excluded Truman from the administration during a world war. He excluded him from key information about how that war might end. He knew he was severely ill. He had to have. It was his fourth term. He certainly had experience in his role. He was irresponsible. And I say this about my favorite of the presidents. Carter's leadership lesson was be responsible and see the risks of not being so. Certainly a transferable skill in all of our roles in business, education, government, industry, etc. Carter may not have been a great president. He arguably may not have even been a good one. But he, like Tyler, set a precedent that has had a tremendous impact on future administrations. Carter's desire to do the right thing led to a transition in the very fabric of how our officials were chosen at a philosophical level. And that ends this second podcast on leadership lessons from U.S. presidents. We hope you enjoyed it. Let us know what you think. Thank you very much.